Rap music may have started in the Bronx, but in recent years it has moved south. The group Goody Mob helped pioneer that move back in 1995. Its debut album, Soul Food, influenced a generation of Southern rappers, among them Bun B of the group UGK. Bun B says the album succeeds in melding party music with lyrics about hard times and celebrations of family dinners. His commentary is for our series You Must Hear This, in which musicians share a piece of music they love.
One, to the two, the three, the four, them dirty red dogs done hit the dough and they got everybody on their hands.
I made a very real connection with that album.
Man, the Cobras got the boys on the lawn in back. Give Paula that Miss Ashley said they didn't get trapped. Behind the black, behind the green, behind the red tent. Dealers breaking off that blower for them wood chips. A lot of faces ain't around, a lot of folks got shot.
At the very least, the music was extremely entertaining. It was extremely enjoyable. But if you really got into listening to the wordplay and the lyricism.
See, never did I think when I got grown that some peewee sacks up and untook this town. See, life's a trick, then you figure out why you really got dropped in the dirty side.
See, in the third grade, this is what you told. You was bought,
you was sold. Now they saying Juice left some heads cracked. I bet you Jed Clampett wanted money back. See, East Point, Atlanta through this roadblock. Tell my all this blow traffic got to stop. So the big time players all John Freeman wait. Had to find themselves another back street to take.
It really was trying to make you understand, okay, look, the way they got you locked down in your hood is the way they've always had us locked down in society. You actually took something home after you finished dancing. You actually learned something. And there's not a lot of people that can say they can do that in the course of a dance song. But I think Goody Mob are great examples of that.
My old boy from the point, but I'm from Southwest. And every now and then I get put to the test. But I can't be stopped, cause I gotta come true. Ain't got no gun, but I got my crew. Didn't come for no beef, cause I don't eat steak. I gotta play the soul food. Chicken,
soul food is gut food, you know what I'm saying? It's food that sticks to you.
Daddy put the hot grits on my chest in the morning. When I was sick, Mary had the hot soup. Boiling, didn't know why, but it felt so good. Like some waffles in the morning, headed back to the woods. Now I'm full as a tick, got some soul on blast and a cassette. Food for my brain and haven't stopped learning yet.
We as Southern musicians and Southern artists, I think, we were all raised on a lot of rhythm and blues and soul music, and we take a lot of those influences and put it into our music. So even though we may be rapping sometimes about cars, there's a lot of times where we talk about real life things.
Everything that I did, different things I was told, just ended up being food for my soul.
Make it your soul food. Well, good old fashioned soul food. All right.
So if you want music that just not being made to get your money, but music that's being made to really inspire you, then Soul Food is that album.
Hold on, see, it's what I write. And Miss Lady, acting like we in jail, says she ain't got no extra husband.
Bun B is a rapper from Port Arthur, Texas. His latest CD is called UGK for Life. His pick for You Must Hear This is Goody Mob's Soul Food. And you can hear songs from Soul Food at nprmusic.org.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tomorrow night, the New England Conservatory of Music kicks off a week-long celebration to mark the 40th anniversary of its jazz program. Pianist Rand Blake has been at the school the whole time. He's become sort of a legend on campus. Even before he joined the faculty, he'd built a reputation for ignoring boundaries between jazz, classical, gospel, and pop. He's released 36 albums of his own. His latest reflects a rather different inspiration, film noir. Andrea Shave, member station WBUR in Boston, has a profile of a most unusual musician.
When I got to Rand Blake's basement apartment, he just had to show me his DVD collection.
Now we're going to go to... This is all Chabrol chronologically. There's Boucher and the second half of Flower of Evil. Thank You for the Chocolate is also quite wonderful.
To understand Blake's music, you need to understand his obsession with film noir, specifically The Spiral Staircase, which he sat me down to watch. Blake's seen it thousands of times and is quick to call it gothic noir.
It's not the L.A. drench city streets with, I hope this doesn't sound sexist, with the blonde, the guy in the raincoat, the pistol shots.
The spiral staircase hedges on horror with a creepy killer, a shadowy Victorian mansion, and storms. Blake says he first saw the movie as a kid when he snuck into a theater in Springfield, Massachusetts.
I never saw anything like this dark house and to have the unknown behind a curtain.
And then there was the music. Sitting at his black grand piano, Blake plays his interpretation of the soundtrack with his eyes closed, as if he's watching the spiral staircase on the insides of his eyelids. For Blake, making music is a cinematic experience.
In rehearsal or in concerts doing solo, lights are down, I'm actually seeing visions of what I'm playing about. So when I do Birmingham, USA, I see Martin Luther King, the school being bombed.
History, memories, montages, flashbacks, scenes from films, from the news, from Blake's own life, they're all in his music. As a teenager, Blake says he visited the Church of God in Hartford, Connecticut, where he heard gospel for the first time.
The noir movies didn't have the kind of music that I got to like more and more. I mean, those chords and spiral staircases and Bernard Herrmann's great score of Vertigo still did not address Ray Charles, Chris Connor, Mahalia Jackson, Aretha, Stevie Wonder, some of the other music I liked.
So Blake moved to New York City when he was in his 20s.
I just would be overwhelmed when you come from a little stuffy place in Connecticut and then you see Miles Davis, who could give an ugly leer. You see all the people in the flesh.
He met Thelonious Monk, Mahalia Jackson, and Milton Babbitt, among many others. Blake got a job sweeping floors at Atlantic Records, where the young pianist was discovered by composer Gunther Schuller.
This man is such an incredible, innovative, unique genius. There's no one that plays like him, and no one ever will.
Blake's unusual approach to piano playing combines modern and classical harmonies, folk music, church music, and jazz. It was something Schuller himself was exploring, a kind of music he came to call the third stream. He says Blake was radical without even knowing it.
You know, it's almost like autistic children can do things that you just can't comprehend how they can do that. And it's something like that because really, truly, he cannot explain at any point what he is doing. But he just has all of this music, both the jazz language and the classical language, in his ear, in his mind, in his heart, wherever it is, and it just flows out of him.
As a kid, I didn't quite fit in jazz or classical or pop, so I got used to playing alone.
Though he has performed and recorded with his own groups and lots of other musicians, Blake spends much of his time playing solo and teaching. Gunther Schuller calls him one of the most generous people he's ever met, and Blake loves to share his passion for music and film noir.
Now, here, Roy Webb's music is terrific.
It's pretty derivative at the beginning. Look at that pile of wood, logs. You'll see that later. The candle plays a big role.
Blake teaches a film noir class at the New England Conservatory in Boston. He spends an entire semester on The Spiral Staircase, using it to teach aspiring jazz and classical musicians how to improvise their own soundtracks. This is 20-year-old guitarist Brandon Lopez.
I've been a fan of Rand's music since I was about 16, 4 years ago, not really long. But he's a brilliant dude. He's almost like this kind of Beethoven figure in jazz, which is incredible. You know?
The people around Blake clearly adore his quirky nature. Even the pianist recognizes that his mind doesn't work quite the way others might.
I want to try to be linear. I think this lack of linearity, though, has probably not made me a giant in music. With these interruptions and these fading shots, these atmospheres and these rain-drenched streets on a fall night with leaves that are congealing on the sidewalks.
So is your life a film, then?
Like, yeah, and I can turn it on and off. It's sometimes a little bit hard.
As long as Rand Blake can dim the lights, close his eyes, and play the music that fills his head, his personal film will continue to roll. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Shea in Boston.
And I'm not going to come right out and call him a hipster, but NPR's own extremely hip Stephen Thompson, the curator of NPR Song of the Day, is with me in the studio to play some of his favorite new music. Welcome, your royal hipness.
You know, nothing is hipper than a 37-year-old dad. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Stephen, this first song we're hearing, is this what I think this is?
This is the Mission Impossible theme.
It sounds as if secret agents had learned to play the violin.
That's right. It's a Stradivarius, in fact, a 290-year-old violin.
Wow. And who's playing it?
It's a Frenchman in his 30s named Laurent Corsia. And he's playing a Strad and on his new album tackling different cinematic theme songs. And so he's taking on the Mission Impossible theme and sort of reinventing it without the ingredients that you're accustomed to, but still capturing the ominousness and a little bit of the tension and a little bit of the spark and drama of the original. And the fact that it still captures everything that people like about the original song while recasting it in a totally different light is exciting.
This next track, also one of your recent picks, is now, just now, seeing the light of day officially after more than 40 years. This song is Troubadour by Tim Buckley.
As she steps near me, my blood feels the chance. All spinning and swirling, it ends for the dance.
Stephen, tell me about this song.
It's been pretty heavily bootlegged over the years. This performance that he gave in March 1967 at the Folklore Center in New York City, right at the beginning of this incredibly fruitful but tragically short career. From 1967 to 1975, Tim Buckley put out, I want to say 9 albums, but this captures him when he's 20 years old. Mm. And you get a sense of just this almost uncontainable ambition and potential. He's almost still finding his voice a little bit. The writer who chose the song describes it as a cross between the Middle East and the Middle Ages, the way this arrangement is constructed.
That sort of Renaissance fair sound, even though that's not the Middle Ages, but it does.
Right, and it's incredibly beautiful, and you just get a sense of this amazing talent who's just beginning an incredible ascent.
Let me laugh through her fingers and smile through her hair. Let me love the one I see, for I know that she's there.
It's always amazing when I hear Tim Buckley because he sounds so much like his son, Jeff.
Yeah, and I mean, part of the tragedy of Jeff Buckley, even though he died a few, you know, Jeff Buckley was 30 when he died and Tim Buckley was 28. And yet, Tim Buckley coming up in this period in the late 60s, musicians were just putting out album after album after album after album. And Jeff Buckley only really made, I mean, in his lifetime, only put out one album.
One studio album.
And then there are all these posthumous releases. Whereas Tim Buckley, you actually got a sense that he realized his potential.
Hmm. Stephen, I want to end with the great Smokey Robinson. And this song is from his new album. The album is called Time Flies When You're Having Fun.
Oh, baby, give me one more chance to show you that I love you.
Amazing that he can still sound like that. This is going to sound familiar to a lot of people hearing it. This track, called I Want You Back, is not actually listed on the record. Why not?
Obviously, it's a cover of a song by the Jackson 5.
Yeah.
And it was recorded and sort of intended for the album before Michael Jackson died. And as you know, Smokey Robinson and Michael Jackson had a very close friendship.
Right.
Smokey Robinson thought of him as his little brother. And so when Jackson died, he still wanted to put it on the record as a tribute, especially since the song is called I Want You Back.
Yeah.
But he didn't want to put it on there as some sort of crass exploitation of a death that has been crassly exploited. So it's included on the album as sort of an unlisted bonus track. Hmm.
The song is I Want You Back by Smokey Robinson. Stephen Thompson is the curator of NPR's Song of the Day and our scout for new music. You can hear full versions of all of these songs at nprmusic.org. Stephen, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, darling, I was blind to let you go. And now since I see you in his arms, I want you back. Since I see you in his arms, you know I want you back. Since I see you in his arms, you know I want you back.
And that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Have a great Saturday night.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, the story of King Records.
Come on!
That's Hank Ballard with the original recording of The Twist, a song later made famous by Chubby Checker. Ballard's version was on King Records, an influential independent label that was founded by Sid Nathan, who ran it from 1943 until 1971. King also recorded the original versions of Fever and Good Rockin' Tonight. Not the most famous label, but this Cincinnati-based label was very influential. It launched the careers of James Brown, Hank Ballard, Cowboy Copas, and Freddie King. In a time of racial segregation, it recorded country, blues, and rhythm and blues performers, including the Delmore Brothers, the Stanley Brothers, Earl Bostick, and Ike Turner. Today we're going to hear the story of King Records from John Fox, the author of a new book about the label, Seymour Stein, the founder of Sire Records, who learned the music business at King, and Bootsy Collins, who was a studio musician at King, where he joined James Brown's band. We'll start with an excerpt of our James Brown interview. Brown not only got his start at King, where he became their biggest seller, his first single, Please, 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 was released in 1956 on King's subsidiary label, Federal Records. In our 2005 interview, I asked James Brown about Please, Please, Please. Now, I understand this record almost didn't get released. Your new book says that the owner of King Records, Sid Nathan, didn't want you to release this. What didn't he like about Please, Please, Please?
Well, it was repetition to him because I continued to say, please, please, please. And he heard me say, please, please, 26 times. And didn't ever, had that kind of concept or that kind of music. Cause it was like gospel ballad, and he couldn't understand the pulsating bam, 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 please, please, please. He couldn't understand that. But that was a new horizon coming by him. He totally different from what he did before.
Well, I guess they made a mistake. So
I'm glad they did.
Please, 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 please. Did me wrong.
Please, Please, Please on the King record label. King launched James Brown's career, and it's where bass player Bootsy Collins got his start at the age of 15. He was a King studio musician and then joined James Brown's band. He later formed his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band. I asked Bootsy to share some King memories. Bootsy Collins, welcome back to Fresh Air. So you grew up in Cincinnati, where you still live and where King Records was based. So before you even started playing at King, did you buy King Records?
Yeah. Well, actually, I probably didn't buy them because at that time we had a couple of friends over at King Records who actually kind of slid us a 45 or two, you know. So anything we kind of wanted, you know, we kind of, you know, asked him, and you know, he knew we didn't have any money. We was a band playing around Cincinnati, you know, nobody really had any money at that time, so it kind of, you know, gave us this, that, and the other, whatever we asked for.
Now, before you started playing with James Brown for King Records, you became part of the King House Band. So yeah. How did you do that? How did you get that job?
Well, actually, we were like pissed over at King Records. We were always there. We were always wanting to see who was going into King Records.
Being you and the members of your band, including your brother.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, my brother and Frankie, the drummer, and actually later on became Robert McCullough and guy named Chicken that played the horn. They came in later, but the rhythm section was the ones that started off, and that was the three of us. And so we started just kind of hanging around over there and just to see the artists coming in. We had no idea we was going to actually get a chance to go in King, you know, because they never let nobody in unless you were an artist and that you were performing and you were doing something, recording. So we were just kind of like fans, I guess you would call. Then we met this guy, Charles Sperling, who was the A&R guy over there at King Records. And he had heard about us, and he wanted to come in and see us play. We had talked about ourselves so much, you know. And he wanted to come and see us. So he came to see us at a club, and he thought that we were great. He thought that we was like we would bring a lot of energy to the new rhythm section that he was looking for, and so he invited us over to King Records, and that was the first time we got in King Records.
So, what was it like when you got inside?
Oh man! I mean, you know, from all that fighting to get in, you know, like wow, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. You know, it was pretty amazing. I mean, it was one thing to see artists going into the studio, but to actually be in the studio and you see them and you hear them recording and putting songs together, it just took it to a whole nother level for us. We were in heaven.
So when you were in the house band and you were playing with different performers,
uh-huh.
What are some of the things that you learned musically by watching different kinds of performers?
Oh man!
Record by having to follow them, you know.
Well,
backing them.
Well,
up.
You know, I would have to say the main thing, I guess, was we went over there. I got to tell you a little story since you asked that question. We went over there and they didn't really know how much we knew as far as recording, and because you know they liked our energy so much, and they liked the fact of how we made the records feel. So I think that kind of helped override what we really knew. So at some point they was going to test us. So the big test was, okay, let's put some music in front of these boys and see how they do. So one of the arrangers over there, who actually became James Brown's string and horn arranger, Dave Matthews, he actually put some music in front of us. Because before that, we were just kind of winging it, meaning we were playing what we felt to the song that they were doing. But I think they wanted to see, okay, can these boys really read or how advanced are they? So they put music in front of us, and we kind of sit there, me and my brother, I never will forget, we looked at each other. Because we was saying to ourselves, how in the heck are we going to get out of this? because, you know, neither one of us could read music. I mean, you know, and they sit it in front of us. And then we had Henry Glover there, who was like the top producer. And all of them was looking at us. We had this big orchestra in there, horns, strings, and we were the rhythm section. So it was like, oh, my God. So we were on the spot, and I said, come on, Cat, we can do this. And I said, Dave, can you run it down one time so we can see how it goes? So he ran it down with the whole band, you know, without us. And I said, give it to us one more time so we can get a real good feel for it because we want to do this right. He ran it again. We said, we got it. We played that sucker one time, and they took it, and it was a take. And they loved it. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, after, you know, grueling sessions like that, 2 or 3 weeks later, Dave pulled me to the side. He said, you know I know you can't read. And I kind of looked at him and started cracking up, and he started laughing. And he said, I understood that you couldn't read in the very, you know, the very first time you played that first song. He said, I knew you couldn't read. He said, but I liked what you did so well that it didn't even matter. He said, I want to spend some time with you. I want to at least teach you some chord changes and how to read chord changes, you and your brother. And that way we can get through this a lot easier and you won't have to feel so so crushed in these sessions. I said, okay, cool. So he took us to the side and started teaching us how to read chord changes. And that's how we made it through, you know, those sessions.
Well, Bootsy Collins, thank you so much.
Oh, this is awesome.
Bootsy Collins got his start at King Records. We'll talk with the author of a new book about the label after a break. This is Fresh Air.